I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, my weekly Can I Just Tell You commentary. That is in just a few minutes. But first, we go behind closed doors, as we often do on Mondays. That's where we talk about issues people usually keep private. Today, we want to take a close look at body image. A new study finds that one-third of those who have had plastic surgery to change the look of their noses have something called body dysmorphic disorder, or BDD. That means they are excessively concerned about some part of their appearance. We were particularly interested in how this plays out in communities of color, who you might be interested to know are actually more likely to have some cosmetic procedures than white people are. We've called upon Dr. Anthony Yoon. He's a board-certified plastic surgeon. You might have seen him on The Rachel Ray Show, where he is a regular guest, or you might have read his memoir, In Stitches, which came out earlier this year. We talked to him about that earlier. So, Dr. Yoon, welcome back to the program. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Michelle.
Would you tell us a little bit more about this new study? It appeared in this month's issue of Plastic and Reconstructive Surgery. That's the official medical journal of the American Society of Plastic Surgeons. It's called High Prevalence of Body Dysmorphic Disorder Symptoms in Patients Seeking Rhinoplasty. So break it down for us.
Yeah, this is an interesting study out of Belgium, where plastic surgeons interviewed 266 patients who came into their office for nose-related surgeries. And what they found is that only 2% of those who came in for functional issues with their nose, let's say they couldn't breathe very well or they had a deviated septum, only 2% of those had body dysmorphic disorder-related symptoms, whereas 33% of those who came in for cosmetic-related issues had moderate or severe symptoms of BDD. And you mentioned, you know, what BDD basically is, this psychiatric condition that people have where they look in the mirror and they see something completely different than what everybody else sees.
How do you diagnose something like that? Because aren't we all that way to some extent?
Well, it's very normal and it's commonplace for people to have some type of issue that they may not like about their body. But the difference with body dysmorphic disorder, or BDD, is that their concern with these patients is way out of proportion to what most people have. And so for them, let's say they have a little bump on their nose, and we see this as a little bump on their nose. Well, for them, that bump is the size of a melon. And these patients undergo, unfortunately, multiple plastic surgeries oftentimes to correct a perceived defect that was really never there in the first place. And this can create a spiraling down of these people in their whole life to the point where almost 30 to 50% of them have tried to commit suicide at some point in their lives.
So that would seem to be a severe condition if somebody is that upset about his or her appearance that one has suicidal thoughts. You've told us that you think that this might be actually more prevalent in communities of color than people might think. Because I think I'll just be blunt about this. I think many people might have this impression that concern about appearance is something that's a bigger issue in the majority community because maybe that's who we see on television and so forth talking about these issues. You're saying that you think this might be actually more prevalent among ethnic minorities. Is that true? And why do you think that might be?
I agree with that, and there are a number of reasons why. Number one, this study really focuses on rhinoplasty, or nose jobs. And in the United States, there are a lot of Caucasians who have rhinoplasty or nose jobs. However, if you look overseas, and the country with the actual highest per capita of plastic surgery is South Korea. You know, I was born here in the States, but my parents are Korean. They're from South Korea. And so I've actually seen this culture of plastic surgery from afar with my relatives. So when you combine, once again, it's rhinoplasty. Now, if you look at other cultures, rhinoplasty is the most common facial plastic surgery among Latinos, among African Americans, and it's a close number two among Asians. And when you look at the reasons why people have BDD, there are some potential neurologic reasons with serotonin and serotonin uptake. But one thing that we really focus on is society. And if you look at society, we're really a society that is unfortunately based upon a Caucasian ideal of beauty. And one thing that if you ever look at the People magazine's 50 sexiest people in the world, there are very few, number one, Asian American males in that demographic, in those groups. And you see that also with other types of ethnicities.
Well, I guess that would be my next question is, I wonder if this is an example of the society pathologizing something that it itself created, which is to say that, you know, the society creates the conditions that makes people crazy and then blames them for being crazy. It sets up a certain ideal of beauty. It's kind of reinforced constantly in the media and in entertainment particularly. And then if you don't meet that ideal, people, and then you do something about it, people think, oh, well, what's wrong with you? That you don't like yourself. And I have to wonder whether this isn't kind of a feedback loop. And the study is kind of, it's a study, but it's implicitly criticizing people for trying to meet a beauty ideal that they didn't create.
That's true. And I think it's more than just that, though, because a lot of these feelings, they are rooted in childhood. And the average diagnosis, age of diagnosis of BDD is 17. And so what happens is children who are African-American, who are Asian-American, who are Latino, they grow up with these images of beauty that are traditionally Caucasian in appearance. Even African-American and Asian-American models that you see, a lot of them have more quote-unquote Caucasian-type features than they may features that are more stereotypical of, you know, their race. And so when these children are exposed to this over and over again, even if you go to Japan and Korea, a lot of those people who are the famous models and actors and actresses, they don't have those typical Asian-American features. You know, they've got the double fold of the eyelid. They have a nose that's a little bit thinner that may have been augmented by plastic surgery. And when these children have these images that are just they're bombarded with when they're children, as they get older, in those who are susceptible, I do believe that they develop these issues with body dysmorphic disorder.
If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We're talking about something called body dysmorphic disorder. Our guest is board-certified plastic surgeon Dr. Anthony Yoon. You might have seen him on The Rachel Ray Show. He also was a guest on this program recently to talk about his memoir, In Stitches. Well, Doctor, you know, to that point, let me press the question with you. You have had, you talked about this in your memoir, you yourself have had plastic surgery. You did this when you were a young man. You were just out of your teens, right? Or you were still a teenager, or reconstructive surgery on your jaw. And now you're part of this field where you are changing people's appearance. And I wonder if you ever feel that perhaps you're part of this cycle of pushing people toward a narrow aesthetic that rather than, you know, encouraging people to appreciate the diversity of appearances that we have in this very large world of ours.
Yeah, and it's something that, just as you say, I'm very conflicted with it. Now, I did have plastic surgery when I was 17, where my jaw was literally broken and reset, and I discussed that, you know, when we talked last time and in my book, In Stitches. But I have been performing myself these types of procedures we talk about, although, honestly, as I've gone forward in my career, I perform less and less of that, and I'm also less and less comfortable with doing it. I think the difference is when patients are having this type of procedure, let's say an Asian eyelid surgery where we create a double fold of an eyelid, or a rhinoplasty where we thin the nose a bit, and they're adults, they're in their 20s, their 30s, their 40s, I feel more comfortable with that versus what you see in a lot of Asian cultures where literally some studies are showing 25% of Korean mothers, of daughters in their teens, 12 to 16, have already encouraged their daughters to have plastic surgery. I am not a fan of any type of cosmetic surgery for anybody who's a minor. And even people who are in their, you know, late teens, early 20s, when they're quote-unquote adults, I'm very uncomfortable performing these types of procedures on them.
Well, what do you say to parents who come in and say to you, look, this is just common sense. You know, this whole black is beautiful thing, brown is beautiful, you know, love who you are thing, that's fine. But I'm just trying to help my child function in the world. And this is, you know, fitting in, meeting that European aesthetic is the way to go. And I'm just trying to make my kid's life easier. You know, what do you say to that?
Well, it's difficult. I've actually had to deal with this even in my own family. I had an aunt who had a daughter who was in her late teens, and her daughter had already actually traveled to Korea to have plastic surgery done. And we were at a family reunion at one point, and she said, and she was actually looking at her daughter and said, oh, look how ugly you are. You need to get your nose redone and your eyelids redone and this and that. And she said, Tony, don't you think she should do that? And I said, that's crazy. You know, she's beautiful. But the problem is these ideas are ingrained in this, in their society and in their upbringing. For me, what I try to do is discuss it with the patients and with their family and try to give them as much insight into these issues as possible. Unfortunately, after I turn them down, they usually go to somebody down the street and we'll get it done anyway.
Do you find it curious in a way that, you know, we're having this conversation that this issue is emerging at a time when there are more diverse images in the media actually than there ever were in the past. I don't know about you, and you know, when I was growing up, when there was an African American on TV, you would run to see it that on the TV. You'd do a call out, "Hey, there's a," I don't remember what words we used, "there's a black person on TV," you know, and you'd run to see that person. And I don't know if it was the same with you, but you know, when you and I were growing up, there were, you know, there was what, Hop Sing on what was that? What's that show? I'm sorry, I'm showing my age here. But one of those Bonanza. I think, you know, there were just very few people of color on television, period, or in the major media, period. But now there are many more. In fact, there last season there are many television shows where there are sort of Asian prominent, you know, characters, and different, you know, not as many as many people would like. But we're having this conversation now. What do you think this is about?
I do believe it's getting better. You know, in the past, when it was really bad, you would see Caucasians playing Asians, playing African Americans. Now we have, you know, our ideals of beauty. It has kind of gotten better, where we have seen Halle Berry be a very, you know, distinct ideal of beauty, but she's also lighter skinned. What we're not seeing yet, however, are people who are, let's say, Asian American, who have very stereotypical Asian features, you know, with eyes that are not wide open. They don't have the double fold. You know, in general, I think society is getting better. You know, we are seeing more and more diversity, but I think we still have a long ways to go. And that's what I'm hoping. And you know, my field of plastic surgery is as guilty as society with the beauty magazines and all that of contributing to this. And I'm hoping that as time goes on, things do get better. You know, as I've gone on in my practice, I've felt less and less comfortable doing these types of quote unquote ethnic surgeries, and I do very little of it now. But once again, I'm just one surgeon.
Well, I think you're quite handsome, and it's good to see you on Rachel Ray.
Well, thank you, Michelle.
Dr. Anthony Yoon is a board-certified plastic surgeon. He's a regular guest on the Rachel Ray Show. He's also been on Dr. 90210 on CNN and other outlets. His memoir is titled In Stitches. If you'd like to hear my previous conversation with Dr. Yoon about his memoir, just go to our website, go to npr.org, click on the Programs tab, and then on Tell Me More. Dr. Yoon was kind enough to join us from Detroit, Michigan. Dr. Yoon, thanks so much for joining us once again.
Thank you, Michelle.
And now we'd like to take a moment to remember the legendary Motown singer-songwriter Nick Ashford. He passed away on Monday after a battle with throat cancer. He was 70 years old. Nick Ashford and his wife Valerie Simpson were the creative force behind some of the biggest and most soulful R&B hits from the 1960s. Here, Ashford and Simpson perform one of their classics, Ain't No Mountain High Enough. That song, of course, was also made famous by Marvin Gaye and Tammy Terrell, and many of the songs Ashford and Simpson wrote became hits for other artists, starting with Let's Go Get Stoned, which Ray Charles turned into a chart topper in 1966. And Chaka Khan would eventually have a hit with the Ashford and Simpson song I'm Every Woman. In a 2006 interview with Ed Gordon of News & Notes, Nick Ashford and Valerie Simpson reflected on what helped them write music that still appeals to audiences today.
Times were different, and I think we were on the heartbeat of America. You know, it's like when you're young and you're being inspired by music, it's really beautiful. And I think at that time, Valerie and I were just wanted to bust out of ourselves.
So eager.
And just had to go somewhere and be somebody. And times inspire you. I think that's what inspired a lot of the lyric.
During the 70s and 80s, Ashford and Simpson went on to have a career recording and performing their own hits. But it's the music they wrote for other giants of Motown for which Nick Ashford will probably be best remembered. Up next, a hot new movie is hitting the big screen this Friday. Zoe Saldana stars in Colombiana.
I was
9 when my parents were killed. I will not stop until you feel what I felt all these years.
She's going after her.
Is a female revenge killer a step forward for women on the screen or not? We'll hear from the ladies in the beauty shop. That's in just a few minutes on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. Nashville is famous for country, New Orleans for jazz, but if you are from D.C., not Washington, D.C., then you know the area's signature musical style is go-go. You've heard it, even if you didn't know what to call it, and nobody does it better than the godfather of go-go, Chuck Brown.
Give me the bridge now!
That was Chuck Brown's hit, Bustin' Loose. His music is frequently sampled by other artists, and he's done collaborations with Marcus Miller, Thievery Corporation, and Jill Scott. And now there is this. He is to be honored by the National Symphony Orchestra in September when they pay tribute to legends of Washington music. And Brown is celebrating his 75th birthday, so he's getting that party started with us. The godfather of go-go, Chuck Brown, is here with us in our Washington, D.C. studios. Thank you for coming.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Also with us is Stephen Reinecke. He is the principal pops conductor of the National Symphony Orchestra, and he was kind enough to join us from NPR's Bureau in New York. Welcome to you, Mr. Reinecke. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Michelle. Great to be here.
So, Godfather Brown, if I can call you that.
Oh, yes.
I call you Diva. I have to call you Devo.
I didn't give myself that name. The fans and the radio stations did.
Well, yes. But, of course, how does it feel to be turning 75? And I do want to mention that I think the actual birthday, but
August 22nd.
But, you know, we actually endorse birthday week and birthday month, so the celebrations continue. How does it feel to be turning 75?
It's a wonderful feeling. I tell you that because I didn't think I was going to make it this far. And it's a wonderful feeling, you know.
How did you react when you heard that the National Symphony Orchestra wanted to pay tribute to you along with John Philip Sousa and Duke Ellington?
I jumped straight up and down. It's the most unbelievable feeling, you know, when I heard it. And I really appreciate it. I really do. I never dreamed anything like that.
Stephen Reinecke, how about you? In fact, I should mention that you're beginning your tenure as NSO's principal pops conductor. How did this tribute come about?
The concert was well in the works before I got involved in it. So here's what happened is the management and the artistic staff at the Kennedy Center and the National Symphony came to me and said, we want you to do the Labor Day concert, and here is the premise. We're going to feature these three artists. And they told me, Sousa, Ellington, and Chuck Brown. And I thought, well, okay, that's how you put together a concert featuring all of that. And the more research I did into all of it, it actually makes great sense. It ties together beautifully because it's a strictly D.C. event. And going in that chronological order, it shows a wonderful path line, and there's a wonderful arc to the concert because we're going to feature Chuck Brown last on the program, and it will become quite the party at that point.
See, we know that you're already one of us because you said D.C., as
That's
I mentioned.
Right.
See, D.C.
That's
is
right.
Those who live here. Washington are those who, pass through.
Yeah.
Right? That's what's up.
It's a specifically D.C. concert.
That's what's up. If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. We're speaking with the godfather of go-go, Chuck Brown, and we are celebrating his 75th birthday. Also with us, Stephen Reinecke of the National Symphony Orchestra. Mr. Reinecke is beginning his tenure as NSO Principal Pops Conductor with a tribute concert to the legends of Washington music, Sousa, Ellington, and Brown. So, you know, Mr. Brown, I know you. It probably drives you crazy when people ask you this, but for those who don't know what go-go is, how would you describe it?
Well, it's another concept of funky music and mixed with Latin and African ingredients and percussion. And the thing about my type of music, of course, I grew up in a church, and my mother didn't allow me to sing anything but gospel at that point in time. And so as I got a little bit older and I left home, I was on my own, I wasn't interested in music no more until I was 24. And that's when I got interested in playing the guitar.
I just want to play a little clip from, you know, you were here at, I know you mentioned that you used to only, your mom would only let you sing gospel. We have our own temple here, our tiny desk concerts, and you were nice enough to favor us with a tiny desk concert a little bit of time ago. I'll just play a little taste just to give people a sense. I know people have heard it, but just to give a little taste of Run Joe.
Run Joe. Run Joe. Run Joe. Run Joe. Policeman at the door. Run Joe. Run Joe. Run Joe. Run Joe. The police, he won't let me go, yo. Run Joe. Run Joe. Run Joe. Run as fast as you can now. Run, Joe. Run, Joe. Run, Joe.
This man got me hand. That tune come out in 1947.
Okay.
Louis Jordan. His concept was a little bit different from mine, you know. And all his kids was running around the street singing, Run, Joe, Run, Joe. And Louis Jordan was hot then. So I decided to use it, you know, and put it back out my own way. And it worked.
Now, speaking of working, Mr. Reneke, how are you going to make all this work? I know a lot of people are used to John Philip Sousa. They're certainly used to hearing the symphony orchestra do John Philip Sousa, anybody who's ever enjoyed one of the 4th of July concerts, and even Ellington. But how are you going to make all that work?
Well, it's our first foray into doing it. It's an experiment, but, you know, we and myself have some experience doing it. I've had the privilege of working with guys like Bootsy Collins before with orchestra, who, by the way, is a great fan of Chuck Brown. What we've done is commissioned a few new arrangements, some medley that includes some of the great hits of what do we have in there? We've got That'll Work, Harlem Nocturne, Bustin' Loose. And then we're going to do another selection with Mr. Brown that is Run Joe, which you just heard. And, you know, it has all these great horn licks in there already. And there's added string parts which are involved. This style of music, I mean, this funk style, you go back and then beyond that you have disco and all of that. There were bigger, larger instruments used in these things a lot of times. And so it fits in this type of music. These new arrangements are just going to fill out and enhance everything that's already there.
All right. Well, sounds like you're ready. All right, Mr. Brown, I understand you're going to play a little something for us. You were nice enough to bring a guitar. You're going to play a little something before we go. But before we let you go, just tell us, I know as you
like
hit the big
guitar,
75.
Yeah.
I'm glad you like it. Before you hit the big 75, or now that you've hit the big 75, do you have any wisdom to share with us?
Well, I tell you, you know, God is good. I have all my trust and confidence and durability comes from God, my family, and, of course, my fans and the bands. So I would, you know, suggest everybody stay focused with whatever you're doing, big or small, do it well. And that way everybody can stand tall. So I feel that since I've been out here, I've learned so much, through experience. Things that nobody ever told me, I've learned just by, you know, being out here. And pay attention to people that listen. People that listen to other people get wisdom. Pay attention to people that are trying to teach you something. That's what I did. My kids taught me an awful lot. They're in college. And I've learned more from them than I've learned all my lifetime. You see, my thing is stay focused. And trust in God and be confident in what you're doing.
All right. What are you going to play for us? You're nice enough to play something. What are you going to play?
Well, you know,
I'm going to let Mr. Reineke go.
I still ain't good as I used to be. I should be.
Well, I'm going to let Mr. Reineke go, so I'm going to thank him. Stephen Reineke is the principal pops conductor of the National Symphony Orchestra. He was with us from New York. And now to take us on home is Chuck Brown, the godfather of go-go.
I love blues. You know, blues and jazz and gospel is really my thing. So I like to do a little bit of that. But first I want to do a little bit of go-go swing. Don't be the thing if you ain't got the go-go swing. Go do-wop, 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 do-wop. It don't mean a thing if you ain't got the go-go swing. We go do-wop, 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 do-wop.
Up next, the Barbershop Guys weigh in on the just-completed MLK Memorial, plus the 21st Annual Convention of the National Lesbian and Gay Journalists Association is underway in Philadelphia. Is gay rights the new frontier in civil rights? That's coming up on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
In 1980, Fidel Castro allowed 125,000 disaffected Cubans to take boats to the United States. Known as the Mariel Boat Lift, the exodus included up to 25,000 criminals. In his 1983 movie Scarface, director Brian De Palma tells the fictional story of one of them, Tony Montana, played by Al Pacino. In the years since its release, this gangster film's popularity has grown and grown. Now Universal has brought out a new Blu-ray edition. Our critic-at-large John Power says the occasion has him thinking about why the movie has a bigger reputation today than it did when it first came out.
Back in school, I was always amused to hear about classics that were dismissed when they first came out. You know, how Moby Dick wrecked Herman Melville's literary career, or how The Wizard of Oz was considered a disappointment when it was first released. I naturally assumed that had I been around back then, I wouldn't have missed the boat like that. But that was before I became a critic and discovered that over the years, you wind up with a pocket full of unused tickets from all the boats you've missed. Take, for instance, Scarface, the 1983 gangster picture directed by Brian De Palma, written by Oliver Stone, and starring Al Pacino, who gives a performance the size of a Caribbean cruise ship. When it first came out, I panned it for taking Howard Hawks' great 1932 movie and remaking it as something trashy, shallow, and excessive to the point of camp. I wasn't alone. The movie received lots of bad reviews, and even the public wasn't wild about it. It was only the 16th biggest box office draw of 1983, behind such cinematic triumphs as Mr. Mom and Jaws 3D. But Scarface didn't vanish like they did. Instead, over the next quarter century, it became a phenomenon. The movie's now so iconic that it doesn't even seem silly that Universal should bring out a fancy, metal-encased Blu-ray version, the Scarface Limited Edition Steelbook, which captures the story in all its lurid glory. By now, most everyone knows the plot. Pacino stars as Tony Montana, a small-time Cuban exile. Tony arrives in Miami along with his friend Manny Ribera, that's Stephen Bauer, and sets about trying to grab the American dream the only way he knows how, through crime. Over the course of nearly 3 hours, Tony rises from being a dishwasher to a drug lord, complete with a gold-bedecked mansion, a gorgeous mall, played with sly bitterness by Michelle Pfeiffer, and personal stashes of cocaine the size of the Matterhorn. Here, Tony, coked to the gills in a fancy restaurant, begins wildly braying at the well-heeled patrons he thinks are looking down on him.
You need people like me. You need people like me so you can point your fingers and say, that's the bad guy. So, what I make you? Good? You're not good. You just know how to hide. How to lie. Me, I don't have that problem. Me, I always tell the truth. Even when I lie. So say goodnight to the bad guy. Come on. The last time you're going to see a bad guy like this again, let me tell you.
I tell the truth, too. And here's an abiding one. If there's any quality that makes a piece of pop culture last, it's energy. And like the chainsaw that dismembers Tony's friend early on, Scarface just roars. It's as indelible as a cartoon, from Pacino's dementedly hammy acting to the bevy of quotable lines, almost none of which are clean enough to be quoted here. Yet the historical reason Scarface became a touchstone is that De Palma and Stone, especially Stone, the most plugged-in Hollywood filmmaker of the 80s, were actually ahead of their time. In Tony Montana's gaudy rise and fall, they predicted much of what we've seen in the last quarter century, the delirious consumerism, the reality TV egomania, the sense of getting ahead as a life-or-death struggle. Most strikingly, Scarface anticipates the rise of hip-hop culture, with its celebration of the gangsta life in all its aspiration and tragic sense of doom. Where a comfortable middle-class white guy like me found Tony's story a preposterous fantasy, rappers like Snoop Dogg and Flavor Flav saw it as a mythic version of something real. It captured their sense of what it was like to be an outsider trying to fight your way to the top, grabbing all the women and bling you could, because you know it could all quickly come to a violent end. They identified with Tony's braggadocio, his desire to live large, and his willingness to fight to the end. As with so much of hip-hop, this taste for Scarface entered the mainstream. These days, teens of all races quote Tony's lines and play the Scarface video game. For them, it's a classic. As for me, watching Scarface again the other night, I still found it comically over the top. But with the benefit of hindsight, I also saw that such an aesthetic judgment is only part of the story. You see, when it comes to pop culture, what finally matters is not whether something is good, but whether it has the power to burn its way into the national psyche. And Scarface undeniably has that power. I never would have believed it, but in 2011, millions of Americans find Tony Montana a figure who's truer and more resonant than Captain Ahab or even the Wizard of Oz.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue and Vogue.com. You can join us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air. And you can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer of online media. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.